Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
you are uprooted and have come to belong.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
An ancient philosopher named Zhuangzi told the story of a man who was traveling across a river in his boat when he noticed another boat coming toward him. It's coming straight at him, and so he starts waving his arms and he's calling to the other boat's driver to adjust his course. The boat's getting closer and closer, and he's starting to curse and swear and scream at the guy, "You're going to hit my boat, you idiot, change course." And so finally, the two boats crash into each other. And so now the guy's in a rage. He's threatening the other guy, calling him names. But then he notices something he hasn't noticed before, and it's that the other boat was empty. There was no other boat driver. The current of the river had pushed the boat and had caused the collision. And so the man immediately stops yelling, because why would anybody be angry with or scream threats at an empty boat? Ask yourself where his feelings went. Because there's still a damaged boat, but now it's clear there was never any intent. No ill intent or anything. There's just this outcome. There's no actor behind it. There could be disappointment about the boat, but the retaliation and the counteroffensive, the injustice demanding restitution, all of that sort of goes away. The river did it. And so one instructive question from this parable might sound like this. What if all the boats are empty? If we can almost effortlessly shift gears based not on the outcome itself, which seems like that's what's telling us how to feel, but based on intent, is there anywhere else where this power might make our lives better, might illuminate the kingdom of heaven in our midst? So today, I want to talk about something Jesus said from the cross, which happened before Sunday, which we're celebrating today, Resurrection Sunday or Easter. But before I talk about this thing that Jesus said, some of his last words before he died and died in agony, I want to see if we can get a little bit backstage on some of this stuff, get to the heart and the mind behind it. In Luke chapter 19, there's a familiar story. If you grew up in church or ever went to VBS, that you know there's even a song that goes with it. It says, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through it. And a man there named Zacchaeus, he was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he couldn't, because Zacchaeus was a short king. So he ran ahead and he climbed a sycamore tree to see Jesus, because he was going to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down the tree and was happy to welcome him. And all who saw all of this, they began to grumble and say, "Well, he's gone to be the guest of one who's a sinner." So before we read the rest, ask, why did they say that? Why did they grumble? Well, they actually had great reason for it, because in short, Jericho at this point in history is where very many obnoxiously wealthy people lived. And there are tax collectors employed by the Roman government to excise about 1% tax from everybody, from citizens. Well, on top of what they're getting from people, they tack on these extra charges and fees, and this is how tax collectors line their own pockets, as long as they pay Rome what they were hired to collect for them. Well, these tax collectors answer to a boss for that region, and that is a chief tax collector. That's what Zacchaeus is. So Zacchaeus, whose name ironically is a Hebrew word that means roughly pure or clean, like faultless, Zacchaeus is this tax collector, this boss. So he walks through town in front of everybody, well-fed and well-dressed, and, you know, got the plasma screen in every room in all of his houses. And he gets all this at the expense of other people who their entire lives could be ruined by a single drought, but they still have to pay taxes, or Rome will come and collect their land from them. So Zacchaeus is not well-respected or loved. And here comes Jesus, the one everybody heard. He's the one that's going to set things right. He sides with the little guy, the outsider, he's here to have dinner with Mr. Clean Hands himself. Typical. He's come to town to rub elbows with power. But Zacchaeus, he either grows a conscience in the presence of the love of Christ, or he decides to stop pretending like he can sleep at night. And here's the very next line. Oh, he's gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner. Zacchaeus stood there. It's like he just holds up the whole thing. He stood there and he said, Lord, look, half of my possessions I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much. Starting today, I'm going to do what I should have been doing the whole time. I'm going to set things right. And Jesus said to him, today, salvation, liberation, release, freedom. Today, salvation has come to this house because Zacchaeus also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and save the lost. It's a beautiful story. I mean, think of the impact this had on everybody that was watching, on Zacchaeus and his family, on Jericho and their economy. It's an amazing story. But what has Zacchaeus done at this point? Because Jesus said something game-changing has just occurred. What is that? What has Zac done? Nothing. He simply declared what he will do. And maybe he did. You ever hear someone say the road to hell is paved with good intentions? Well, two things about that. One, why is that road paved? The road to hell should just destroy your tires and your suspension. But more importantly, the Bible seems to say, here and in other places, that the road to liberation, salvation, to waking up, that road is the one that's paved with good intentions. Zac has only announced what he intends to do, and Jesus says, that's enough. Today, there's magic and all enough to celebrate. And we're not even told the rest of the story. That's how important the intentions are. It's almost as if Jesus sees the person apart from the actions and the behaviors. As if he understands that what is happening doesn't automatically mean it was the result of clear intent, one way or the other. Jesus doesn't yell at empty boats. He knows that what we want to do, what we wish we could do, what we know reflects our higher, healthier, better self, that person inside who wants that is seen and encouraged and loved, apart from and maybe despite what's actually happening, what we're actually doing, how we've actually behaved. What if the Spirit of Christ sees us the way a loving parent sees their own child who isn't at their best? And if she just had a nap, you would see she isn't normally like this. This isn't who they are. What if Christ is like that? What if the Spirit of Christ sees us the way that, you know, real animal lovers see what everybody else calls a bad dog? They say, there's no such thing as a bad dog. That's an abused or terrified or desperate, wounded dog. But those behaviors. Underneath all that, there's an absolute angel. I mean, what if God sees us sort of like that? What if the Spirit of Christ sees us the way we hope others will see us? And we know that because we do say things all the time like, you know what, I'm having an off day. Things have been really stressful at work or at home. I've had this head cold for 3 straight weeks now. I'm just frazzled. My kid just got sick for the 3rd time in the daycare this month. We're running on E. My parents divorced when I was 13, and I've just not gotten over it. Now, you might be thinking, hang on a second, this all sounds nice, but we can't just keep making excuses and expect that other people then fully excuse us. And that's a fair point. Maybe you're thinking about that time Jesus even said, you will know them by their fruit, not what they say, but what they do. You know, you will be seeing the actual person, not by what they declare, but what their life actually produces. You know, this good intention thing, that seems nice. Maybe Zacchaeus was a one-off, but Jesus seemed to be more about what you actually do. Like, that's who you are. Well, there's maybe some truth in that. So I want to note that when Jesus said you will know them by the fruit of their lives, what their lives actually produce, What he actually said was, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravenous wolves," which is different than our wolves you disagree with, other animals that maybe are wrong or disagree. They're ravenous. They act pious and devout, but they intend to destroy you, to get your money, to collect you in their number, because if their numbers get bigger, their movement seems more valid. Beware of them. Watch their actual lives. You'll know them by their fruits. See, that's not the same thing at all. Jesus is calling out religious hypocrites who you can observe aren't who they say that they are. They're lying to you on purpose. They're claiming to be better than you. But if you just observe their lives, you can see they're the same as everyone else, and therefore maybe worse because they manipulate others and their money with God talk. Jesus isn't referring to people who are actually trying best they can understand with the mental, emotional tools they have at their disposal. They're doing their best. See, I think if we take Jesus' specific warnings about religious or political leaders that have power and they're using that power to trick you, so measure their lives, not their words. If we apply that to everybody, then what we have is a God that doesn't care about intent, genuine intent, a God that doesn't look at the heart despite being called the heart knower in the Bible. We'd have a God whose sense of right and wrong isn't even as nuanced as our own human justice systems. Because you know, as well as I do, if you kill somebody on accident, that's a different crime than intentionally killing someone. And different again from intentionally killing somebody with like weeks of planning. The interior world matters greatly. Or else we could just keep screaming at empty boats. None of it would matter. See, you and I are not simply a long list of misbehaviors in the eyes of love. We are souls. We're complex. We're nuanced. And this realization is a gift to us, but at the same time, it's an invitation into some work that we're going to probably want to try to resist. It's tricky. To be a people of love, though, we have to gently and persistently shed all the unloving and inconsiderate and stubbornly disinterested habits within us and follow Christ into this way, into seeing people more and more as Jesus sees them. And here's a way I remind myself of how this isn't just be nice, you know, childish spirituality. Let's think together about how many different behavior influencing factors people have in their lives. Over 40 million adults, that's about 1 in 5 people in our population, have an anxiety disorder in the U.S. Nearly 1/3 of adults reported anxiety and depression symptoms last year. 1 out of every 3 adults you live your life around are affected to some degree in their nervous system in ways that moderately to severely impede their ability to engage the world and other people the way that they wish they could, the way that they would if things were better for them. Worldwide, anxiety disorders, that's the most common mental illness. 70% of adults in the U.S. have experienced some type of traumatic event at least once in their lives. So that number doesn't account for those who've had 2 or 3 or 10. 223.5 million people have at least one traumatic nervous system altering event in their story. And about 6 out of every 100 people will have PTSD at some point in their lives. As many as 30% of survey respondents have said they have a sleep disorder. 50 to 70 million adults in the U.S. are affected by a sleep disorder that, of course, they carry into their day. 25 million adults in just the U.S. have obstructive sleep apnea. According to the CDC, about 51 million people, more than 20% of U.S. adults, have chronic pain every day. 17 million adults, 7% of the adult population, have high-impact chronic pain every day. Think of the millions and millions of people we're talking about, that everything they do and say is buffeted by a mind and a nervous system and a body that refuses them access to their best self in a given moment. And this all leaves out most of the other stuff, like people struggling with addiction, how that affects their ability to live from their best selves towards you and I, those who have someone in their life that's dying or has just died, those who have huge relationship problems that limit their trust, their internal resources, undiagnosed neurodivergence, you know, people are showing up the only way they know how to, but it comes across sideways or deficient for others or employers or whoever, and then all the other real life stuff that's happening to us all the time, leaky roofs and kids' grades, the check engine light, the headlines for crying out loud. And then there's the fact that some of us, we just don't understand the effect that we're having on other people. We just don't know how we come across. We don't mean anything by it. I mean, if you're looking at a tattoo idea, here's one. It's called Hanlon's Razor. It's this rule of thumb that says, never attribute to malice what is adequately explained by stupidity. So how many of us, we don't have any bad intent. We haven't thought through our words and actions very well. See, most of us have multiples of these boxes checked, multiple things holding us back in any given moment from our being, or doing our very best toward other people or ourselves. Pain and suffering and disappointment or difference or whatever it is, it's affecting all of us. And frankly, pain and suffering, they don't knock and ask if there's anything else going on before they enter. Hardship is almost never a one thing at a time courtesy. Everywhere you and I turn, there's going to be a person or entire groups of people who don't have access to their best. There's every reason to believe that they would do better if they could, and that they will do better as soon as they recognize how and when. Or you and I can just keep screaming at boats, whether there's anyone in them or not. Now, some people, for stuff like this, they're like, oh, come on. Everybody's got trauma now. Everybody's got some issue in their past. You know, everybody's got an excuse why they don't have to take responsibility. Maybe I'm quoting you. I don't know. But isn't it funny how we can be towards those whose minds are burdened and unwell? Because you never say that sort of thing, you know, oh, everybody's got cancer. Everybody's following the trend and amputating their gangrenous limbs these days. Is it funny how we do that? Let me level a little compassion challenge at us here. A lot of people do have anxiety and depression and trauma and PTSD, and it's probably far more than are diagnosed. You could bet on that. But maybe many say they do and technically don't. Whatever. Why not compassionately say, what is it that's making this person claim to have anxiety or some diagnosis? Like, who would do that unless they were admitting they wish they could do better, but they haven't found a way to yet? And so rather than saying, I just don't want to, they're saying, I think it's this. That means they're trying in their own way. Why invalidate them further? Why not understand they're trying to figure out why trying hasn't worked? They're telling you they wish they could do better, if not for hurdles they're still trying to understand. Sometimes I hear people say, it can't be that many people with mental illnesses. Okay, what if it's half then? I mean, what if you heard 100 people were starving, but it turned out only 50 of them were actually starving? The other 50 were only hungry or afraid they might someday starve. Like, why do people have to prove they deserve our understanding or our kindness? Here's a free insight. The more other people making excuses bothers you, and I'm putting making excuses in fingers, the more that bothers you, the more you're discovering something about yourself and why you don't believe there's room for your own excuses. And why? Well, probably because somebody told you to shut up and stop complaining earlier. And if you don't get to be understood, then nobody does. What we do and what we intend are always gapped and often at odds. And we get frustrated and insulted very often because we let ourselves forget what's true. This gap exists between other people's intentions and their actions. We forget that that gap exists and that we have the power to respond to this truth with peace and understanding. In the same way, once we realize there's nobody in the boat, we can turn all kinds of things off. It's almost effortless. So with all this in place, we come to the crucifixion and this familiar scene and a quote you've heard before. Toward the end of the Gospel of Luke, this dramatic tension in the story reaches its peak. The soldiers have already beaten Jesus to near unrecognizability, and then they lead him out to finish him off. And it says, when they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified Jesus there along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Now, growing up, I always heard that us sinners know exactly what we're doing. That's why we're accountable, that we're so taken in by evil that all we want to do is evil all the time, and we are accountable for that. But here Jesus speaks, excruciatingly bolted to a torture stake, that about the issue being that those inflicting this violence on him, the Romans, and those who turned him over to the Romans to make this happen, the Jewish religious leaders, it wasn't conscious evil. It was a kind of ignorance, a kind of unknowing, an inability to act from their higher selves. And this is, I'm told, the first time in literary history that the non-conscious mind is referred to. The first time somebody spoke of a human being's ability to act in a way not connected to their better self. Jesus is asking for the forgiveness of those who they haven't asked for it, and they might never ask for it. And let's be honest, look at the scene. They don't deserve it, right? And yet he does it. Is this Jesus weak for doing this, or is this a strength of his? Are you weak when you work to see people more deeply than their worst actions towards others or towards you? Are you tapping into the very strength of the crucified one, or are you being weak? Jesus' love and wisdom, his strength, allows him to separate what we thought was inseparable. He sees a distinction between the actor and the action. For those of you in chemistry class, Jesus knows that actions and intentions are a compound, not a mixture. So for Jesus to pray this, especially in his circumstances in that moment, it shows us that the things we do to others, what has been done to us, the wrongs, the sins, the pain inflicted by those we trusted or thought we knew, it really did hurt. It really might have consequences. There has been ruin caused toward us and by us. But it's not as simple as that somebody sat down and sketched out what they were going to do and did it. It doesn't work that way. There's always a disconnect stemming from countless other mental, emotional, physical, cultural, personality factors. And you can call all of that spiritual. These factors that go all the way back oftentimes to our formative years that skew and misrepresent the image of God within us, our very best. And Jesus can see past all that. And Jesus invites us to learn to see past it too. And when we begin to see, however imperfectly, even in the willingness to see, because we know it's there, we become free. We become centered and situated in immense strength because we've begun to see below the surface of our identities, below obvious action, down below all that, where the reality of ourselves is, where we're all the same, where our true selves have been buried or cocooned or insulated under years of unconscious, autopilot, reflexive living. We know this is the case. How often do you apologize and say, I didn't mean that. That came out wrong. I regret that I did that. That doesn't represent me. We know this is true. We can already see this in ourselves. There's someone else more thoughtful and considerate and wiser and at peace underneath these habits and reactions that I seem to reflexively employ in the world. And Jesus can see that. And Jesus invites you and I to start seeing it and to start living from it. What if forgiveness, or more generally, grace, was taking on an attitude with people that it sounded something like, I don't like what you did to me or to others, but I'm also aware that if you were free of all the things that anchor you and limit you and blind your mind and your heart, you wouldn't have acted that way. And so I hope that you and I can see you and I more clearly soon. See, the amazing thing about Jesus's prayer of forgiveness is that it means people were forgiven before they ever eventually asked for forgiveness or understood what their sin was. That's a power that we're invited into. People are almost always doing their best, wishing they could do and be better. And often their best isn't enough to be fully trusted, of course. But to see this from the power of Christ's love means even then we, in our happiness and our kindness and our peace and our identity, aren't at the mercy of others. Even our boundaries would be rooted in the seeing love of Christ. And if we don't want to follow Jesus into this way of seeing, this way of grace, that of course has in it the power to forgive, but it's bigger. It's the power to be gentle and kind with ourselves and everybody. If we resist it, it might be because we need people to have done what they did on purpose. It was calculated. It wasn't ignorant. They were intentionally evil. That way we can continue blaming them and punishing them because we believe that's where the power is. Maybe there are some of you, you got people you can't forgive. I confess, I counted this week to make sure. I think I've got 4 people in my life I still haven't forgiven. I don't even want to enter the work into it. I'm closer than I've ever been. I will. I just can't do it yet. So I say that to say, I understand what this resistance is like. And acknowledging some of you, you've had far worse happen to you than I've had happen to me. And again, some things that people do, however disconnected from their highest selves, it was awful. There's consequences. Consequences that contain the person because they neglected to contain themselves. Consequences that allow for good, or at least the reduction of evil. So that's not revenge. So much of what we call justice or consequences, it's revenge. No, sometimes consequences are applied because they know not what they do, and that's what's hurting people. That's consequences. So of course, these complexities are how real life works. But let's not confuse acknowledging these complexities with the resistance to grace and forgiveness that some of us carry. Because like you, it's not boundaries or wisdom I'm always employing. Sometimes I insist that people did what they did on purpose so that I can call them evil. Sometimes I demand to join together what Christ said is actually separate. Sometimes I demand to retain the right to scream at empty boats. Sometimes I demand to be hurt, because if I'm not hurt, then who do I blame for not turning out better than I did? I sometimes demand to be crucified and to tell God, don't forgive them, mop the floor with them, and get it on video. I'd like to watch. You're not inferior if you cannot apply grace and seeing to everybody yet. Not at all. But you and I are not yet operating in the interest of love's power and in the peace and the happiness that brings until we open ourselves to seeing what Christ said is there to see. People are not their sins. They are, like me and like you, the image of God, who have deeply forgotten themselves at somebody else's expense, including their own. And if they could figure out how to be better, they would, and they might possibly be better someday. The gift of reconciliation, of peace and healing within and between ourselves, it comes from more and more willingness to see one another. Father, forgive all of us. We want to do better, but we're ignorant as hell. And to the extent we can't fully allow ourselves to see for the way the crucified Christ sees, applying grace, well, we'll apply grace to that inability or unreadiness too, because you and I are doing the best we can right now, and we'll do better when we're ready. Easter is about the resurrection of Christ, and yet we've really focused on the crucifixion. That's because God does the resurrecting. It's our job to take up the cross. Jesus invites us not to, you know, punish ourselves. That's not what taking up the cross means, to prove our sincerity. It's taking up the way of the cross, joining him in the way of a profoundly different kind of love, a love that comes from seeing people, seeing them even as they do you or others harm, seeing them even when revenge or rage or contempt feels better, seeing them as Christ does, and therefore sharing in the power to not believe less about them than is true. It's a beautiful and enormous challenge, and we have to help each other and ask God to help us. But in this way, the resurrection can be well understood as God vindicating Jesus as that which should keep going. Like God saying, among other things, that Easter morning, I can't let this end. This has to keep going. This way of love that refuses to believe less about humanity than is true. Death can't have this one. This must rise again and continue. So to be a people of Christ's love is to say, I want to be part of what God won't let die, the way of radical seeing love. And as we look at our world and what our lives need, the healing that we need, we don't need more people focused on the afterlife or doctrinal debates. We've got to focus on following the spirit of the crucified and risen one into love and forgiveness and reconciliation, into a kind of seeing we've not enjoyed yet. And the result will be, for all of us, more kindness and peace in the life we're meant to live. My friends, may we have the courage to hope not just for some vague notion that things will get better someday, though we do indeed hope that. May we have the courage to join the crucified and risen one in hoping specifically for every person we meet, for every person who has failed or disappointed or hurt us, that they will see themselves deeply and learn to live from that depth, and that others will apply the same hopeful graciousness to ourselves as well, that they might see us as intending far better than maybe we've achieved in our words and actions to this point, and that by God's grace, we also will do better tomorrow than we did today. And in all this, may love heal and reconcile us all. Amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.